I cannot yet comment on the preaching, but the music has been outstanding. And so it has already been worth being here this afternoon, if for no other reason than to hear the Lord praised in such a magnificent and glorious way. It is an honor for me to be with you today. I've looked forward to this with more anticipation than you could imagine. I am thrilled that I believe the Lord has in the future a very close working relationship with Southeastern Seminary and Shaw Divinity School. We have the president of the university coming to speak in chapel in the fall. And if I can work it out, and I'm going to do everything on my end to make it happen, we will also have Dean Robertson to come and preach, and also Dr. Taylor. I've not had the chance to meet him before, but he is a man for whom I've had enormous love and respect for many, many years, and I did not know that he was in Raleigh. And the moment I found that out, I went to our Dean of Students and said, we have to have him on our campus, and we need to do so at the earliest possible date. And so, Dr. Taylor, you can expect a phone call very, very soon. I want you to take your Bible and join me in the Gospel of John, the 9th chapter. John chapter 9, and this afternoon, I want to speak to you on the subject, when darkness meets the light of the world. John chapter 9, and we're going to give our attention to the entire chapter, but in preparation, let me read for you verse 1 through verse 5. Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the work of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Helen Adams Keller was born June the 27th, 1880, in Northwest Alabama. She was a normal, healthy girl who could both see and hear. However, when she was about 19 months old, she contracted a disease and ran a very high fever. We're not certain, but most likely she either contracted meningitis or scarlet fever. She survived, but it was very evident shortly thereafter that she was now both blind and deaf, and her world had been cut off. But all that changed when a lady by the name of Ann Sullivan walked into her life. Helen was about 6 at the time. Over the years, she would simply refer to this lady as teacher. In her autobiography, The Story of My Life, Helen describes the way her life was changed when she met Ann Sullivan. Listen to what she wrote. Have you ever been at sea in a dense fog when it seemed as if a tangible white darkness shut you in and the great ship, tense and anxious, groped her way toward the shore and you waited with beating heart for something to happen? I was like that ship before my education began, only I was without compass or sounding line. And I had no way of knowing how near the harbor was. Light, give me light, was the wordless cry of my soul, and the light of love shone on me in that very hour. I felt approaching footsteps. I stretched out my hand, as I supposed, to my mother. Someone took it, and I was caught up and held close in the arms of her who had come to reveal all things to me, and more than all things, to love me. In a similar but more awesome encounter, nearly 2,000 years ago on the streets of Jerusalem, a man that the Bible says was born blind from birth, had a face-to-face and up-close and personal confrontation with him whose name is love, him who is the light of the world. Not only would he receive sight to his eyes, but also his soul would be enlightened as well. physically and spiritually born blind. Light would now enter his eyes and light would engulf his soul. Our text is in the days immediately following the Feast of Tabernacles. This was a time when they remembered God's faithfulness to the nation of Israel when they were in the wilderness, remembering a pillar of fire that would guide them at night. Four giant candelabras would be lighted there in the temple area. It is said that they were so magnificent, all of Jerusalem could see them. It was on this occasion that Jesus stepped forth and made his second of the seven great I am sayings in the Gospel of John, the text that was read earlier, John chapter 8 and verse 12. I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. Now in John chapter 9, almost as if to authenticate this incredible claim, Jesus does something that has never been done before or since in redemptive history. He healed a man that was born blind from birth. Chapter 9 is very strategically located. It is sandwiched. Rejection on the front end at the end of John chapter 8 and rejection at the end of John chapter 9. In both instances, amazingly and tragically, it is the religious leaders that reject He who is the light of the world. But in between there, there is this man, born blind, born a beggar, as the text says, but God is going to do something magnificent as he reveals himself to him. And in many ways, what you have in John chapter 9 is nothing less than a parable or an illustration of what salvation is all about when the light of the world enters into our soul. I want to look at this text this afternoon around three major movements that I think will guide us to see just what takes place when darkness indeed meets the light of the world. Note with me, first of all, in the first 12 verses that when darkness meets the light of the world, we will see the works of God. Jesus is passing through. He has just encountered the Pharisees. They tried to stone him. Because in John chapter 8 and verse 58, he makes perhaps the greatest declaration to his deity found in all the Bible. Going back to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14, he says, "Before Abraham was, I am." They clearly understood what he was doing, so they sought to stone him. But his time was not yet, and so he simply passes through their midst. And chapter 9 and verse 1 tells us, "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth." We learn also from verse 8 that he was a beggar. Most likely he had stationed himself close to the temple, eking out a meager existence, completely dependent upon the mercy and the kindness of others. Jesus sees this man, and so the disciples. But rather than being moved to help him, they decide this would be a good time to have a theological seminar. And so they want to engage a question that always bothers all of us, the question of theodicy, the problem of pain and the problem of evil. How can we indeed explain suffering and sorrow and pain and hurt in a world where there's a good God and an all-powerful God? And so also buying into the false teaching of the day that I believe misunderstood texts like Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5 that talked about the sins of the fathers being visited upon the children to the third and fourth generation. They put the question before Jesus in verse 2 and they said, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus takes advantage of their question. In the process, Jesus helps us understand that when darkness meets the light of the world, we will see the works of God. Two things Jesus wants to drive home as we think about this particular issue. First of all, Jesus would say we need to understand what really matters. He says in verse 3, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." Now, let me be fair to the disciples first. Generally speaking, their theological tracking was on course. The fact of the matter is, all sin, all suffering, all tragedy is the result of the sin of our original parents there in the Garden of Eden. We live in a sinful, fallen world. Romans 8 tells us even creation is groaning, longing for and waiting for the redemption of the sons of God. But they made a mistake in their theologizing, for they tried to understand how this general truth could connect up in each and every instance with a particular kind of situation. And in trying to do that, they go beyond the biblical evidence, they go beyond any theological justification, and they make an unwarranted extrapolation from the presence of evil and sin in this world. Jesus helps them understand that this man's blindness, first of all, was not parental. He helps them understand, secondly, this man's blindness was not personal. No, this man's blindness was providential. It was not caused by God, but God would use it for His glory. Before time began, God knew that this man would be born blind, and God knew that there would come a day when he who is the light of the world would step in to his dark world. Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Four times in this text, Jesus emphasizes that he came to do the work of God, that the works of God should be revealed in him. Verse 4, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is still day. And while it is night is coming, there's coming that time then when no one can work. And so Jesus Christ makes it clear that what really matters is that when we step into this world, whatever it is, we come in to do like Him the works of the One who sent us. We must understand what really matters. But secondly, we must also understand what really matters and who really matters. You see, the what is important, but the who is even more crucial. A while ago, we heard the wonderful text of John 8:12 read. That is the first time Jesus makes the declaration, I am the light of the world. But now again, here in verse 5, he says it again, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And so now theological debate gives way to divine tenderness. And Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the light of the world, steps into this man's life. And notice what the text says there beginning in verse 6. Now, when he had said these things, he spat on the ground and he made clay with the saliva and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. Think about it. Spittle, clay, putting that on his eyes. Well, that's high class medicine, isn't it? That's what you and I would expect if we made our way over to Wake Med or over to Duke. We would expect a little clay, a little spit, having that rubbed in our eyes. Of course, again, theologians, they can't be satisfied with just what the text is saying. They want to ask, why did he do this? And the bottom line is, we don't know. The text doesn't say. Some say that perhaps it's following a pattern of creation, and some say maybe it was an inducement to faith, and others say maybe it was a requirement of obedience. Some even said that perhaps subtly it is a declaration of his authority over that which is unclean. The fact of the matter is we don't know why, because the issue is not why. The issue is the who is in the midst of operating on this man's eyes. And so verse 7. He said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. One of the things that we emphasize when we talk about expository preaching is that you do not neglect or ignore the context of the passage. For sometimes what goes before and what comes after provides wonderful, wonderful insight into the text that you happen to be expounding at that particular moment. I don't think it is by accident that Jesus here in verse 7 sends him to the pool of Siloam, which actually means the pool of sent. Guess what? If you go back to chapter 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times, you will find the word sent. In each of those instances, it is a declaration made about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the light of the world. And in each case, something different is said that gives us insight into His person and His relationship with the Father who sent Him. Just look at it with me. Verse 16 of chapter 8. I am with the Father who sent me. Verse 18. The Father who sent me bears witness of me. Verse 26. He who sent me is true. Verse 29. He who sent me is with me. And verse 42. If God were your Father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and came from God, nor have I come of myself, but He sent me. And so the one who is the true sent one sends him to the pool of sin. And what do we find out? We find out that the water of sin cleanses this man's eyes just as certainly as the one who was sent from the Father will cleanse any and every soul that puts their faith and trust in Him. Verse 8 reads, 7 says, so he said to him, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sin. So he went and washed, and he came back seeing. It's interesting. One man pointed out that Jesus never actually said in the text, as we have it recorded, that go and wash and you'll see. He just says, you go and wash, and he obeyed. He did not necessarily know what the end would be. He did not know what the outcome would be. He knew this. He was blind and he was a beggar. He knew no one else had ever been able to do very much for him. Maybe this man would be different. Maybe this man had an answer for his problem that no one else had ever been able to put before him. And so he obeys, and in just a very simple, straightforward, no elaboration statement, he went and washed, and he came back seeing. Yes, the man born blind has now met the light of the world. The healing was not natural. The healing was not medicinal. The healing was not psychological. The healing was supernatural. What a grand, glorious, wonderful day when this man for the first time could see a tree, could see the water, and as we will learn even later, could see his mom and his dad. Now, you would think, as I would, that as a result of this, there would be great celebration. There'd be a wonderful time of partying and joy and rejoicing. But unfortunately, that's not what we read. There in verse 8, we encounter the first of several dialogues that we will see in the remainder of the chapter. Therefore, the neighbors and those who had previously seen him who was blind said, is not this he who sat and begged? And some said, well, this is he. But others said, no, he is like him. But the man said, oh, I am he. And so then they asked the very basic and naturally logical question, how were your eyes opened? And he answered and said, a man called Jesus. He made clay. He anointed my eyes, and he said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and I received my sight. Then they said to him, where is he? And he said, I do not know. Oh, but in time, he will. So the first thing we need to see this afternoon is when darkness meets the light of the world, we will see the works of God. Secondly, in verses 13 through 34, we will also see the wickedness of man. What should have been an occasion of great celebration now becomes an occasion for a grand inquisition, a tragic and evil interrogation. Three groups will stand out in the remainder of our text. It's interesting to note Jesus disappears until verse 35. The Pharisees will be very prominent. The man born blind, of course, will be at the focal point. And his parents, likewise, will be brought into the situation in a most tragic an unfortunate manner. We will also see from each of these groups three different responses that take place when darkness meets the light of the world. First of all, in verses 13 through 17, we see that some will condemn the light. Look at it with me, verse 13. They brought him who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. It was a Sabbath. Oh, my goodness. already our hair rises up on our arms and our heart picks up a rapid beat because we know that problems are on the horizon. The Pharisees worshiped the Sabbath. The Pharisees took something that was made for man and turned it on its head and used it and abused it in a tragic way. And so now we understand why there's no celebration. Now we understand why there's no party. Now we understand why there's not great rejoicing, because it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, same simple answer we've received before. He put clay on my eyes and I washed and I see. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God. Why? Because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others, however, could not deny the great miracle that had occurred. They could not deny that this is something they had never seen before. And so the text says, but others, there was a division said to the blind man, what did he say to you? How can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And so they asked him, who opened your eyes? And now he's making some progress, isn't he? Earlier he said, the man Jesus. Now he says, the prophet. He's moved from seeing a mere man to now seeing a prophet. But just stay on with me. It's not over yet. It's going to get really good by the time we get to the end of the story. Again, the Pharisees had made something out of the Sabbath that God never intended. And Jesus, it seems like, went out of his way to tick them off and just give it to them on the Sabbath. He's already healed a man on the Sabbath back in John chapter 5. And in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 8, Jesus declared himself the Lord of the Sabbath. But they were not happy. They were not pleased. He had violated their man-made religious traditions. You say, how? Well, he'd worked on the Sabbath because he had made clay. Furthermore, in their traditions, it was only right to heal on the Sabbath if it was a matter of life and death. Bottom line, they would say, he can stay blind another day. He can be lame another day. You can wait another day to do the great work of God. So because he had violated the Sabbath, they began to interrogate this man. They began to pepper him with questions. And again, he gives the same answer as he had given earlier. All I can say is, he put clay on my eyes, I washed, and now I see. If they had simply gone back to their own scriptures and immersed themselves in the Old Testament, they would have known that giving sight to the blind would be a sign that the Messiah and the messianic age had dawned. In Isaiah chapter 42, the first of the great suffering servant songs, Isaiah writes in chapter 42 in verse 6 and verse 7, I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness, and I will hold your hand. I will keep you and give you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the Gentiles, to open blind eyes. Again, Isaiah 35, verse 5 and verse 6. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf, they shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For water shall burst forth on the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The blind man simply says, I can see. He's not just a man. He is a prophet. His weak faith grows stronger. Their weak faith grows weaker. Some will condemn the light. But secondly, in verses 18 through 23, some will conceal the light. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been born blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, is this your son, who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? And his parents answered them and said, we know that he is our son and that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age. Ask him. He will speak for himself. They're cautious. They're careful. They are intimidated. They will tell some of what they know, but I am convinced they do not tell all that they know. I have a hard time believing that they did not know who healed him. We've already been told back up in the text there that he said the man called Jesus, verse 11. You think when he ran home and for the first time in his life saw the daddy who loved him and the mother who birthed him, you think he just said, "Hey, I can see," and that's all he said? You think after giving a big hug, they just said, "Well, isn't this nice? Now let's sit down and have supper." No, I imagine that she began to cry. I imagine the father began to jump. And they said, "How did this happen?" He said, "The man, Jesus. He did it. He did it." But now, instead of having the opportunity to rejoice with their son, these religious know-it-alls pull rank and begin to intimidate. They begin to put pressure upon them. And as a result, the text says very, very clearly in verse 22, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." You know, fear is a paralyzing enemy. It can cause us to be silent when we know we should speak. It can even cause us to lie about what we know to be true. It can even sometimes cause us to turn our back on those that we love. Yes, it can even lead us to deny the light that we see with our eyes and know with our mind and even feel in our hearts. Yes, fear is a great thief. It robbed these parents of the joy of their own son's miraculous healing. And you know what? It can rob you and me as well if we're not careful. Yes, some will condemn the light. Some will conceal the light. But some will confess the light. Verse 24. So they again called the man. The earlier conversation with him yielded little fruit. The further conversation with the parents was not sufficient. So once again, they called the man who was born blind, and they said to him, "Give God the glory." And how do you give God the glory? By making this statement, "We know that this man is a sinner." They give him a solemn charge. They put him under oath, as it were. You give God the glory, and you announce and you declare, "This man is a sinner." Then comes what is clearly one of the most wonderful and fantastic statements in all of the Word of God. It is one of those great verses that speaks to all of us on so many different levels. I have no doubt that John, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, intended for there to be this kind of impact when we read these verses and we read these words. For he says there in verse 25, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. You're the theological experts. You're the ministerial muckety-mucks. I'll leave that up to you. But one thing I know. Once I was blind, and now I see. I don't know about all the theological discussions. I don't know about all of the religious rigmarole. This one thing I know. Before this man stepped in my life, I was blind, but now I see. I see. I can't explain it any more than I can explain the new birth. I was blind, didn't see, didn't even know I was blind. And then Jesus steps into my life and gives me sight that I did not even know existed or was possible. And this man born blind says, "I can't explain it. I just know this. I see. I see. I see." One of my heroes went to be with the Lord last November. His name was Adrian Rogers. One of the greatest preachers, I believe, that has ever walked the planet. Major, major leader in the Southern Baptist Convention. Just a godly man. And when he was reflecting upon this text, he said, and I quote, "A Christian with a glowing testimony is worth a library full of arguments." That's good. That's good. A Christian with a glowing testimony is worth a library of arguments. Well, the text gets kind of funny now, and I'm going to pick up the pace. Because now the blind beggar becomes the theological instructor. And these Pharisees get in over their head, though they would have never expected such to take place. Verse 26 says, "Then they said to him again, 'What did he do to you? And how did he open your eyes?'" And the irony, perhaps even the sarcasm, is just too real to ignore. He says in verse 27, "I told you already. You did not listen. What do you want to hear it again?" And then, boy, does he nail them. "Do you also want to become his disciples?" Oh, my goodness. Oh, my soul. He just poured salt in the wound. He just gave them a right cross. He just put them in their place, and now they go theologically ballistic. They fall back on their traditions, and they say there in verse 28, "Then they reviled him, and they said, 'You are his disciple. We are Moses' disciples. We follow the law. We follow the old ways. This new guy on the block is a nobody, a nothing. We know where we came from. We follow Moses. We know where we are from.'" Then verse 30, "The man answered and said to them, 'Why? This is a marvelous thing. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we don't know where he's from. You're saying that? Well, this is amazing to me that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. It seems to me that if you would try to search out anything, you'd try to figure out who the guy is that can do this kind of thing. Nobody else has ever done this before. Nobody, it's never been like this in our lifetime. And so you don't know where he is from." And oh, does he begin to work them over. Now we know, verse 31, that God does not hear sinners. "But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, this is the one he hears." Verse 32, "Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." His wisdom and his innocence are startling. Here he is, a poor, blind beggar, now instructing the great theologians of Jerusalem. His logic is flawless. His argument unparalleled. There's virtually no way to refute what he has said. God honors those who worship him and do his will. Verse 31. "What this man has done has never been done before." Verse 32. "If it were not from God, he could do nothing like this." Verse 33. His argument is something like this: the evil one doesn't go around opening blind eyes. And so this can only be from God. And so now he's moved. He's a man. He's a prophet. He is a man from God. The Pharisees are undone. The Pharisees have nowhere to go. So what do you do when you are engaged in debate and you have a weak argument? You engage in what we call the ad hominem argument. You attack the man. I can't refute your argument, so I'll attack you. And this is what they do. Verse 34, "Then they answered and said to him, 'You are completely born in sins. And are you teaching us?' And they cast him out." They revert back to that false theology, and they in essence say, "You know why you were born blind, boy? Because you're a sinner. God made you blind from birth because you are evil, because you are wicked, and you got what you deserved." And then the worst fears of his parents are realized in the life of their child. They cast him out. They threw him out. But again, my hero Adrian Rogers says, well, yes, the religious leaders shut him out. But Jesus sought him out. And that brings me to my third and final moment this afternoon. Yes, we will see the works of God. We will see the wickedness of man. But thirdly, we will see the wonder of salvation. And let me go ahead and lay out for you the two principles I see in verses 35 through 41 because they really hang together and they complement each other. First of all, light received will always result in greater sight. Light received will always result in greater sight. But light rejected will always result in greater blindness. Light received, greater sight. Light rejected, greater blindness. You see, there's a principle in Scripture that goes something like this. Revelation brings responsibility. The more you know, the greater your accountability. And Jesus himself reminds us that if you do not embrace that which you receive, you even lose that which you have. And here we see this unfolded for us there in verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" Some translations have the Son of Man. That may be the better reading. He's simply taking him to the question of the ages that he put before the disciples at Caesarea Philippi. "Who do you say that I, the Son of Man, am?" He answered and said in verse 36, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" I agree with those teachers who say probably the word Lord in verse 36 is best understood in this context to mean something like sir. It's at this point just a term of respect because he doesn't yet know who he's talking to. And so he says, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He says, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And then he said, "Lord, I believe." And he's worshiped him. John MacArthur points out that saving faith has four essential components. It requires divine initiative. You didn't go looking for God. God came looking for you and for me. It requires divine initiative. Secondly, it always responds in faith. Thirdly, it recognizes Jesus as the Christ. And fourthly, it will always result in worship. And now we see a remarkable journey, do we not? Back in verse 11, he's a man. Verse 17, he's a prophet. Verse 33, he's sent from God. Verse 35, Son of Man. Verse 38, Lord and God. What a journey to conversion and salvation. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 18 and 19 says, "The path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter until the perfect day. But the way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble." And so light received results in greater sight, but light rejected results in greater blindness. Jesus said, as I mentioned a moment ago in Luke 8:18, "Therefore take heed how you hear. For whoever has, to him more will be given, and whoever does not have even what he thinks he has, it will be taken away from him." The Pharisees have evidently followed the man out of the synagogue, out of the temple area. They overhear, they eavesdrop on his conversation with Jesus. And Jesus says there in verse 39, "For judgment, I have come into this world that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." Now, very quickly, in John 3:17, Jesus says, "I did not come to this world to condemn the world." But here he says, "I have come for judgment." You say there's a contradiction. No, no contradiction. You see, Jesus did come to save. But when you reject his salvation, you invite his judgment. If he came to save, there must be a judgment side on the flip side. And so Jesus says, "I've come into the world that those who do not see may see, and those who think they see," is his implied meaning, "may be made blind." And some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words. They said to him, "Are we blind also, and a chapter that begins with blindness tragically ends with blindness as well. Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see, and therefore your sin remains. And Proverbs 26:12 says, do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope for a fool than for him. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3 and 4, even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel, of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. Blind eyes need more than light. Blind eyes need sight. And Charles Spurgeon, that great British preacher of many years ago, said it just right. It is not our littleness that hinders Christ. It's our bigness. It is not our weakness that hinders Christ, but our strength. It is not our darkness that hinders Christ. It is our supposed light that holds back His hand. Do you recognize today your blindness? If you do, then there's hope for you as well as for me that we may see. God bless you.